You are listening to a documentary podcast.
Episode 4.
Hi, I'm joined here. Well, for the sake of the interview, you'd like to be called
Tree.
Tree. Is that a nickname from long gone?
Well, it relates to my name, which I'm not going to go into, my original name, which obviously my parents gave me. It has something to do with Robin Hood. I'm sure anyone who's intelligent enough could work out Robin Hood riding through the...
Okay.
Also, I like to be called Tree because people generally piss on trees.
And you feel hard done by?
Not particularly. You know, everyone has their ups and downs in life and stuff, you know. I'm not saying I'm the luckiest guy alive. I'm not the most unfortunate guy alive.
Now, you're kind of self-proclaimed as being crazy or mad. Or at least you tell your friends that you are.
Well, that's a bit of a joke. I am bipolar. I was diagnosed 6 years ago in San Francisco. But I've suffered from extreme depression since as long back as I could remember. You know, I've lived in a very dark place for a very long time. I'm now on very good medication, so my mood's a lot better. But I get my odd days where I'm very low still, and, you know, I generally don't suffer from suicidal tendencies, or I haven't in, oh, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. I still do the odd stupid thing. I'm certainly not as crazy as I used to be, which I'm very thankful of, because that means I'll probably live longer and that'll keep my mother happy.
When did you first realise that your mind behaved differently to what was kind of the accepted norm?
I've always almost been persecuted for being a bit more outspoken than everybody else, you know.
You worked quite a lot in creative fields.
Yeah.
I mean, advertising, I mean, seriously creative fields where if you don't come up with an original idea as such, you basically can't do the job.
Yeah.
Do you think that, I hate using the phrase, but thinking outside of the, what would you say?
Triangle, circle, there oblong, tube, whatever.
Is
did you mean box? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Tried to think outside of that, but I never found a door.
Yeah. Do you think that kind of this high-pressure lifestyle may have pushed you over the edge at one point?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. When you're working 15 hours a day, 7 days a week in the creative industry, you know, to stay on top of the game, to make sure you're still the best, it's, you've got to do it. Otherwise, someone else will take your place. It's as simple as that.
You were working in London on quite a fat wage for a top advertising agency. What happened to you?
Well, I used to freelance. I've never actually worked, had a permanent job. I was a freelance CD for, well, quite a few top agencies. And I just got sucked into the whole rock and roll, sex, drugs, rock and roll thing. And, champagne all the time, free massages, free taxis, great parties, free drinks, free drugs, you know, and plus a very healthy wage, as you've just mentioned. And I was very young when I went into it. I was headhunted, and I don't know, it's at that sort of age, you're not very responsible. Incidentally, I've wasted all the money, you know, as you do, because you do pay for it in the long run. But
how do you pay for it?
Well,
I mean, do you pay for it in more than just financial?
Oh, definitely, yeah. You pay for it in your health. You can't fire on all cylinders forever. You've got to learn to relax, which is something I never used to do when I was working. You know, I could never stop my brain from ticking and ticking and ticking. And, I'd say majority of exceptionally creative people are, you know, another stupid expression is there's a fine line between genius and insanity. You know, maybe there is a line, maybe there isn't.
Maybe they just blur into one another.
Exactly, yeah. Who knows? You know, leave that up to the scientists or these silly people who come up with these quotes.
You been called a genius?
Only by myself.
Have you been called insane?
Yeah, oh yeah.
By others?
By others, yeah. No, some people have called me a genius, but that's yet to be proved, I'm sure.
You're listening to documentally.com. What happened to you then? What was the biggest low?
Well, when I was very young, I used to... I've taken overdoses and expected to not wake up. I've used to try to hang myself with my school tie, don't know if that was relevant.
This is way before school. Way before you working in the outside world.
This is the age of 13, yeah.
So at the age of 13, you're having suicidal tendencies.
Well, I actually tried to commit suicide on about 4 or 5 different occasions.
How do you feel when you hear other people say that, though? I tried to commit suicide. Don't you think that is it more a cry for help?
In most cases, I'd say 95% of cases, yes, definitely. If you, I don't know, take your overdose and then phone someone up and say, I've just taken an overdose, you know, goodbye, then that's a cry for help. If you take an overdose and then go to bed and just say, well, I'm not going to wake up in the morning and don't tell anybody, that's not a cry for help. That's you want it over.
Is that how you did it?
Yeah, that's how I did it, yeah.
I'm obviously very happy that you're crap at committing suicide.
Yeah, I'm not very good at anything, to be honest, anymore. Never was.
And so you're trying to kill yourself at school with your school tie.
Yeah.
How did that? What happened?
The tie broke. Cheap ties, polyester rubbish. I should have used silk.
After that?
Well, I got told off by the doctor and the GP because I had marks around my neck, which when you strangle yourself, your blood vessels burst in your neck. And I was taken to the doctor by my mum, who always had an inclination of what I'd done. And the doctor said, has anybody strangled you? And obviously, at the age of 13, so no, they just happened. The doctor knows better. You can't trick the doctors, obviously. So I got, you know, a talking to and everything, and they wanted to stick me into therapy and all this. And I was like, no, I'm fine. And I never went into it. Because most therapists, unfortunately, they've not been through it. They've just read the books. And I personally believe unless you've pretty much been through it, you can't really talk to somebody about it, you know.
So you think... Did you just assume from the beginning that there was no point in going to therapy because no one was going to help you?
Yeah, definitely.
But then at 13?
But at 13, you think you know everything, I suppose. And
Was there a space then between then and the next time you felt that depressed?
No, not really. I've always been very depressed. You know, I've always lived in a very dark world, but...
Were you not given medication at a young age?
I was given... Well, the thing is with being bipolar is they generally won't diagnose you until you're at least in your mid-20s. But mostly, generally it's later. I was diagnosed at, I think it was 24 or 25.
What's actually the definition of bipolar?
Well, I'm bipolar 1 rapid cycling. That means I cycle a lot. My mood swings can change. One minute I could be manic. I'm never manic, to be honest. I've only had three manic episodes in my life. But
what happens when you're manic?
It's like taking 50 grams of cocaine. And
Do you know what it's like to take 50 grams of cocaine?
Not at once, it would kill you. But in a week, yeah. in a month, maybe, I don't know. You lose count after 3.
And then after this, after the manic episode?
You crash. And you're back to hell again. The last big manic episode I had, I think, this is the major one I've actually had in my life. I went out to Australia for the millennium. And I was very depressed the first 3 or 4 days I went out there. And then I decided, all right, I'm going to go get drunk and party. So I partied very hard for 3 months, spent about £35,000 on alcohol alone in 3 months.
You were obviously buying rounds?
No.
You drank £35,000?
That's not including the free drinks I got. I used to go down to the Yacht Club in Sydney Harbour, and I knew the people behind the bars, and they used to give me schooners of brandy, and I used to drink them like pints.
You had this money in the bank, and now, obviously, it's not. I mean, £35,000, was that your earnings?
Yeah, that was a few months' earnings, yeah. I didn't intend spending all that money, but you generally don't, do you?
So, was that a way of self-medicating, I suppose?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I mean, it's escapism, and it's self-medicating, you know. I understood I was trying to self-medicate. It's very odd. I mean, a fantastic book I read was Electro Boy. About a rapid cycling bipolar as well, and he used to forge art.
I mean, there tends to be a lot of connection between extreme creativity.
Yeah.
Could it be that you think too much?
Well, yeah, definitely, yeah. Yeah.
Can you stop thinking? No.
I can't switch off, no.
How do you get to sleep at night?
Sleeping pills.
When was the first time you were medicated?
18, at university. I went out partying too much in my first year at university, so I never actually went and did any work past the first term. And then the second two terms I failed, so they said they were going to fail me in my first year. I could either repeat the first year or go into therapy, and then I could come into the second year. So I thought, well, I'm not repeating the first year. Had a minor nervous breakdown, I think, because I just didn't know what the hell I was going to do in my life, you know, because the university was the be-all and end-all at that point, because that was what was drilled into me. If you don't get your degree, you're a failure, you know. I now realise that's complete crap, but... at that, when you're 18, you know, at Manchester, there's a lot of partying going on. And most people, after a few months of partying, knuckled down. I started hanging around with rock bands and taking extremely large amounts of acid with a couple of my close friends and E's, which were great then, but they're no good anymore. Never been into the speed thing much.
Any drugs you didn't try?
No, can't think of any.
You even, you know, you went right down the Class A route and involved with heroin.
I've never injected heroin. I've only smoked it.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, all of this, was it another way of, should we say, self-medicating? Or?
Yeah. I've only done heroin a few times. I mean, I didn't like it. It just made me feel sick. Made me a bit dizzy and felt sick. You know, crack's just crap.
You are listening to Documentally.com. Your family weren't aware of any of this at the time?
Before my father died, I don't think they were. But after my dad died. I think I've learned the hard way is you can't trust too many people with your secrets, you know. And you've got to be careful because people will abuse you for it. And they'll tell you they care and they'll tell you they love you and all this lot. And before you know it, they've got their hands down in front of your trousers. And...
So you've been betrayed by numerous people.
Definitely, yeah. Well, when you're crying out for help, people just see a free ride, you know.
How did all of that affect you?
Fuck it, I don't care. You know, I'm a better man than them because I've learned to accept and deal with it, you know.
At the time, were you that optimistic?
No. I mean, I was getting abused when my dad died the night my dad died. I should have been there to say goodbye, but...
How did your dad die?
He had cancer and worked his ass off his entire life. Doctors said that, you know, there was nothing really wrong with him, a bit of bronchitis or whatever. And they said, sorry, we've got it wrong. These tumours everywhere. And I think he died 9 months later. He just went from being a very strong man into a very weak man. Never complained once. And he never let me help him from the toilet or anything like that. And I used to go and see him all the time because obviously I was in London still. And, I just had this weird feeling that I was never going to see him again the last time I saw him. And I remember saying to my mum, you know, I don't want to go back. I just want to stay up a few more days. And she said, he'll be here next week. I went back to where I was living with somebody. And, never saw him again. Just got the phone call. And the person I went to cry on, you know, I needed a shoulder to cry on that night. And, you know what happened. You know,
they abused just your
trust
yeah. Shall we say, yeah. Well, sometimes it is better not to see a loved one in the last throes.
Sometimes
it's best to remember. When was the first time you actually kind of sought help for how you were feeling?
Well, I was seeing a girl who lived in California. I'll just say California. And she was studying bipolar, and we're not in touch anymore, which is a shame because, you know, I still care about this girl deeply, but she decided it's best not for us to keep in touch, and that's fair enough. She just said, you know, we should go and see a psychiatrist. Within the first 10 seconds the psychiatrist goes, I know what's wrong, you know. And he was quite shocked that no one had ever picked it up before. But
How would it have been diagnosed before that time then?
I don't know. In England it's difficult. I mean, you know, because when they put me in a mental institution, they stuck me on Haldol.
How did that happen?
Well, I took an excessively large amount of drugs one night, and so I got delusional and started to imagine things which weren't there. Buried my mobile phone, expecting it to grow into a tree. Someone instantly stole that and then wrapped up a £200 bill before my brother managed to cancel it. Sorry, thought that. Newspaper articles written about me, thought that, you know, I just got exceptionally paranoid. And
how far did this paranoia go?
oh, I thought the secret police were after me and everything, you know. And whether there is secret police or not, who knows? But I, you know, I thought it was just one big conspiracy theory against me and everything like that, you know. It was the drugs, obviously.
This was directly after taking a lot of cocaine?
Cocaine.
How soon after?
Marijuana. A couple of days, you know, went on the come down. And, you know, I think I just took my quota. I just pushed it a bit too far and, you know, I should never have, shouldn't have done it, but I was hooked on the stuff at that point. I stopped in a nice hotel in Chelsea and ended up trashing the room, basically. So the police came, they didn't arrest me, they just wanted to know what was wrong, so they took me down to the station to look after me, phoned my brother up, he drove down from London, picked me up, and took me home, took me for a pint, and then the paranoia really started. And so I went into hospital voluntary. I wasn't committed, and then made the mistake of telling my teacher chickens to do karate for a bit of a laugh. So what, they locked me up.
What did you say?
I taught chickens to do karate for my living, and
just doing normal questioning
for a bit of a giggle.
Is it a good place to be sarcastic?
No. You. If they say, "What do you do for a living?" you tell them the truth. You do not laugh, you do not smile, because they don't care, they just, you know.
What happened?
They said that we'll send a doctor around tomorrow to see how you feel, and I didn't see a doctor that day, so I said, "When's the doctor coming around?" "Don't worry, he'll be around tomorrow. Don't worry, he'll be around tomorrow. He'll be around tomorrow." 3 weeks later.
3 weeks?
"Can I see the doctor, please?" And they wouldn't even let me out of the ward, you know.
And you were there voluntarily?
Voluntarily, yeah.
Any point did you feel like just walking out? Could you have just
walked? I couldn't have walked out. There were security gates and securities and everything.
So, did you feel, at the point of making the joke, "I teach chickens karate," were you feeling pretty sane then?
Yeah.
So the paranoia and everything.
It was just a joke. The paranoia had gone by then. I did one out, but, you know, I just thought, oh, if I have a bit of a joke with them, they'll understand I've just got a bit of a sense of humour. And, but they don't have a sense of humour.
What kind of people were in there with you?
Psychopaths. People that were just too dangerous to go to prison. You know, kickboxers, Irish street fighters, manic depressants, suicides, people that were paranoid, schizophrenics.
What was your first instance of realising that this was a scary place?
I was about to go into the toilet and a bloke walked out of the toilet and his arm was covered in blood because he'd just cut himself up with a scalpel all over his arm, and there was blood everywhere in the bathroom and everything. And at this point I realised I don't belong here, you know. These people do need help. Like, for that night I needed help, but they shouldn't have kept me in there that long, you know.
Was there any other instances that you remember?
Yeah, there was one bloke in there who, he was okay, but he needed help. And there was a kickboxer and a street fighter who decided that basically over a packet of cigarettes they were going to see who could beat him up the most, you know. I split that fight up, luckily, because of, you know, I don't know why, but for some reason people seem to listen to me in there. And I said, you know, look, we're all in the same boat together, we've got to all stick together here and everything, you know. There's no reason to be violent to each other, you know, just because we're angry that the fact that we're stuck in somewhere we don't want to be. We'd all rather be down the pub. The difference between them and me is they're all allowed out, and there was a pub over the road, so they all went and got pissed up every afternoon and come back, you know, and stoned.
Everybody thought that was fine, the nurses and the doctors.
Yeah, they didn't care about them, but they wouldn't let me out, you know. It took them 2.5 weeks before one of the nurses would walk into the local village with me, just so I could go for a coffee outside the hospital.
So, was your time there a time filled with fear, or were there any good moments, or at least relaxed moments?
Fear. But that was half due to the medication, Haldol, that was sticking me on. I was at quite a high dosage of Haldol.
What exactly does Haldol do?
Well, it relaxes you. To me, it just made me exceptionally ill. You know, I just felt I was having shaking panic attacks and the stuff and everything. And I told the doctors about this, so they just gave me more and more and more. And the way they saw it was, the more we give you, you know, the better it'll be. And it wasn't chilling me out, it was making me worse and worse.
Was there no other options for you?
No. Haldol's the cheapest, crappiest thing you can get your hands on, you know.
You never had one laugh?
Well, one example of I thought for a bit of a giggle one night, we'd all get in the conga line. I led it. Sing along and dancing around the wards, shouting, "We're all fucking crazy." And the nurses didn't like me doing that too much.
So are you in a uniform or can you wear normal clothes?
Oh, no, you're in your normal clothes.
I'm just trying to picture this. You leading a conga night saying, "We're all fucking crazy. We're all..." Okay.
Yeah, so they kept me in a bit longer for that. And, yeah, you know.
Please, if you want to email me anything, questions, answers, whatever you want, just send them to podcast@documentally.com. How did you eventually get out?
My mum got me out. I was transferred to a different unit.
Oh, and, mum's great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And they cooked you too.
You were transferred to a different unit?
A different unit.
Was it a day unit or a...
No, it was another lockup. I thought I was getting out. Okay. And they told me I was getting out, and then they went and stuck me in another high security lockup.
A high security again? Yeah. Is this why they were assessing you? Or?
Yeah, yeah. So I realised the last 3 weeks I'd been in hospital, 2.5 weeks or whatever, they'd not done a thing. They hadn't assessed me, they'd done nothing. And I spent 2 days in this new hospital, and I made it quite clear to my mother, if you don't get me out now, you're never going to see me again. You know. And she said that's fair enough, and I was out 20-30 minutes later.
Fantastic.
You know, because I wasn't committed, I was voluntary.
Yeah.
And so I left, you know.
Do you not feel that they could have done anything for you?
Of course they could have, they just didn't want to. You know, they lock you up, throw away the key and just say you're mad.
Do you think there's a lot of people go into these places that come out cured?
No.
No,
I think it's, if you know, obviously it's a very difficult subject to go into, because mental people, well, mad people, whatever you want to call them, you know, weirdos.
Of which you could be classed as one of them.
Oh, I'm the weirdest, mate. People are just happy that they're locked up and out their way, because then, you know, society can go on as normal and everything like that. The nurses aren't qualified to deal with it. The doctors haven't got time to deal with it. And they're the ones that care. You know, half the doctors don't care.
They say 1 in 4 people in the UK anyway, yeah, suffer from some kind of mental disorder, for want of a better way of putting it. Do you feel that if everybody was aware of that and society accepted it a little bit more, the people with the mental disorders would feel a little less pressure and therefore be allowed to talk about it and therefore suffer less?
But I mean, let's take this 1 in 4. So 1 in 4 in the same Great Britain, surely the British aren't that much different from anywhere else in the world. I've lived in America, I've lived in Australia, and it's the same over there. So let's say it's the same everywhere. That's 1.5 billion people. That's a lot of people that are crazy.
That's almost calling it normal.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there are less people with ginger hair.
Yeah, yeah. So I think we should lock all people with ginger hair up.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure Chris Evans would be happy about that. Yeah. But again, suffers from depression, apparently.
Yeah. Allegedly. Oh God, depressed and ginger hair. I think it should be shot.
How do you feel nowadays? I mean, how long ago is this episode of confinement?
Oh, it was 6 years ago now.
When were you diagnosed bipolar? How many years ago?
About 5 years ago, yeah.
5 years ago. Yeah. So it took a trip to America.
Yeah, and a considerable amount of money.
And an understanding girlfriend.
Yeah.
For you to actually... Do you see that as a breakthrough, as a coming through the other side?
Oh, definitely. It's just nice to know that you're not a loony. There's actually a disorder you've got, and it's not actually your fault. It took me years to realise it wasn't my fault.
This is strange how guilt tends to be involved.
Oh, everyone who suffers from mental illness, I'm not sure if it's because of society or anything like that, but they do blame themselves, you know, which they shouldn't, because going back to Chris Evans, you don't blame yourself for having ginger hair. It's genetic. It's at the end of the day, to cut a long story short, it's just a shame that majority of people persecute you because you're slightly different. But if you ever do anything fantastic with your life and then you die, they'll go, "Wow, wasn't he great?" But while you're alive, it's like, no, he's just weird.
So the medication you're on now, does it help?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Yeah.
And do you still see psychiatrists?
Yeah, yeah, I saw one the other day, yeah. We ended up just talking about how bad marijuana is and what the scientists are now doing to get people even more hooked on marijuana and how much of a problem marijuana is to general society all over the world.
You really think that, feel that strongly?
Yeah.
Not just from personal experience?
Yeah. Oh, I was hooked on the stuff for 12 years.
It's funny because some people say that you can't get hooked on marijuana.
Yes, it's very addictive. They're wrong.
Addictive in what way to you?
Well, to me, it was addictive because, well, it is actually scientifically proven that it produces more endorphins. Anything that produces more endorphins that your body is used to will make you addicted to it.
How long has it been since you've done, not including alcohol, drugs?
Oh, cocaine, 4 years, 5 years, not sure. Marijuana, a year.
That's pretty good going then.
Yeah. Yeah.
For an addict.
Yeah.
So now you would say you could pretty much leave it behind?
Wouldn't touch it again if you paid me.
Have you been in the situation?
Yeah, loads of times.
That's great.
I mean, that's great because you obviously see
it as being a harmful substance for yourself personally. Yeah. Do you think that it's a harmful substance for everybody? Can you put everybody under the same?
No. Some people will... Yeah, you know, the odd joint now and again to chill you out, I've got no problem with that. But if you are smoking, you know, a fair bit a week or every day or whatever, you're playing Russian roulette with your brain, you know, you're but if people aren't willing to research it and if they're stupid enough to smoke the stuff and to stick stuff up their nose and that, just thinking it's a bit of fun, fair play to them.
In your case you just feel, just knock it all on the head.
In my case, if I was ever to touch it again, probably, I'd be safer if I did put one bullet in a gun and play Russian roulette. At least then I'd have a 1 in 6 chance.
I've never heard it put like that before. Mm. You are listening to Documentally.com. There's going to be people listening to this podcast, at least I hope there's going to be people listening to this podcast. That
it helps.
A few of those people that feel like they are the 1 in 4 and are recognising... maybe only now that they have mental issues, should we say.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you could say to them that might make them feel a little bit better about it?
Don't keep it to yourself. Be honest with your friends, your close friends and your family, people who love you and care about you, and they will support you. Research it, explain to them, look, it's not my fault, you know. Get your mum or your dad or your brother or your sister or your best friends to read up a bit on it so they understand where you're coming from. It's not hopeless. You know, there is medication out there, which luckily for us British, we get it on the National Health Service. Unless you're on Medicare or something in America, because obviously it's all privatised, it's difficult to get, which is something I'm not going to go into. It's... can be scary, but there is always a light at the end of the tunnel. And I really wouldn't blame yourself for it. It's not your fault.
Excellent. So, I see a person that has his finger in a lot of pies, both creatively and musically. You've got all kinds of projects going on at the moment. The person on the street, the person you talk to, the person at the end of an email is not going to tell the difference between you and any other member of society.
No.
Would you say there's an element of a success story in the fact that you actually did go, get some decent medication, got some help, and now you are...
Yeah. Okay. I don't know where I'd be without the medication and the support I've had off friends and family and everything like that. I hope I'm not the only lucky one, and I'm sure I'm not. You know, it's like I said before, just, you know, be honest with people. And if they're prejudiced towards you, it means that they don't want to be your friend because you're... crazy or whatever they define you to be, then they weren't a real friend. Send the fuck off.
You've got projects. You're obviously not starving, judging by that pot belly.
You cheeky bastard. And judging by the fact that you've just bought me a packet of crisps. And that was my breakfast.
Your choice.
They were quite nice, actually. Yeah. Apart from the tea's gone cold now.
Oh, sorry about that. Always make you another one. Well, I want to say thanks very much, and I really appreciate you being open and frank. And if there's anything else you'd like to add before we sign off?
Oh, I don't know. Cravolto non pave non deve mai terregare.
That's Latin, you nutter.
Oh, no, of course.
I don't want you listening to any angry music. Songs of madness and obsession.
You have been listening to a Documentally podcast on documentally.com. Thanks, and I hope to see you again. Well, at least speak to you again.
I think I'm going to crash.